Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. I want to mention that KHOI Community Radio has a 10th birthday celebration coming up August 20th. So think of us. Can you believe it? 10 years. I think we've been doing so pretty darn good. So we always have good things to talk about on our show. Besides some corn and beans in Iowa, there's other things that are grown too. We often like to point out. And this time of year, we can delight in summer flowers. Oranges, pinks, whites and golds, marigolds, lilies, sunflowers, zinnias, riot of color. And I love planting flowers. I plant easy stuff. And the rewards in pleasure are many. Today, we're going to talk to a flower farmer. And as we shall learn, flower farming is not for pansies. Meredith Nunakoven from Barn Swallow Farm near Oskaloosa, Iowa. Welcome, Meredith.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, tell us about Barn Swallow Farm. Besides flowers, there's lots of things going on. So how did you get started? What's your farm like?
Well, our farm is in total a couple hundred acres. On the actual flower farm area, we farm flowers on 10 and a half acres and also farm those on 3 acres where my Airbnb sits. We have everything from perennials to bulbs to annual fresh cuts to dahlias. Flowers is just a part of the diversity of our farm. We also row crop. We have acres in CRP. 3 years ago, I just installed 6 acres of hardy Iowa chestnuts. Bred and grown here on Redfern Farms and planted. And we love farming. I love farming. I've been farming with our family. I'm a fifth-generation farmer, a returning beginning farmer, I would say. We could talk more about that. But I really love to farm. I really love being here in Iowa and using my creative energies to sell products.
Sounds like you have an awful lot on your plate. Why did you return? You say you were someplace else and you came back to Iowa.
Yeah, my parents were really promotive in education away from the farm. And so at 19, I left for 7 years in Omaha, Nebraska at Creighton University, where I have my undergraduate and graduate degree, my master's in business, and also a BFA in design. And then from there, I went on the road working in filmmaking for almost 15 years. And so I would work in management positions running everything from short films to commercials, TV shows, and also major motion pictures everywhere from Utah to Rhode Island.
Oh, well, so, and you made the choice to come back. You didn't come back to relax, though. You came back because of farming. And what is it about farming that drew you back?
Yeah, I mean, I bridged my career with farming. I would work on the road from October till March and then would come back and farm from March till October. So I was working very full years in my 30s and late 20s. And so I'm not sure. I as far as my love of farming, it comes from growing up in it and loving to work with the land and experiencing nature and making products out of that and, you know, giving a little bit of joy to someone else. I think flowers especially make people happy. And so happiness is infectious, right? It helps me get out of bed every day.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful.
So are you farming with your family or on this is the same place you grew up?
Yes, this is a family farm. My father grew up on the actual homestead was purchased by my my grandfather in the 50s. And so a lot of that legacy is very big for me to think about, that I'm upholding a lot of what other people put a lot of hard work into. So that's a little bit of a weight on my shoulders. But otherwise, yes, it is a family farm. Both sides of my family have been farmers, either livestock, stock farms, row crops, very traditional farming here in Iowa. So flowers is a little bit off, off the beaten path, I would say.
Why did you decide to go flowers?
So why did I decide to go into flowers? Was that the question?
Yeah.
Well, my mom and I had a love for flowers, honestly, since experiencing my grandmother's garden, which is outside of Knoxville. She always grew zinnias and snapdragons. She had peonies. She was a lover of potatoes. I remember being asked to go over there to help her dig them, and that was not my favorite job. But there was always a lot of joy in the garden with my grandmother, and that then transcended to my mother and I. We were huge buyers of daylilies, which we have thousands of specimens on our farms. But daylilies are full. And so at one point we had to figure out that we would only plant things on the farm that we could use. Use what you have and have what you use is a big mission for us. And so now anything that we plant is either able to be used in bouquets, or it's used for a reason of beautification, or to sell our farm in some way so that we can turn something into a profit.
Good. How long has the flower business started? It seems like besides planting the things, talk about your markets. Who is your customers for the flowers?
Right. So we didn't even know how to start a seed. Right. So we needed education. So what I would say to everyone is, please go educate yourself. And knowledge is power, as I say. So we attended germination seed classes back in 2010 and 2011 with Indian Hills Community College down in Ottumwa. And we learned how to seed everything from tomatoes to marigolds. And those were some of our first crops. And as the years went on, we got into dahlias. So some of the dahlia tubers we sell now are from mother crops from over 10 years ago that we started to invest in. So I would say it's been over a decade-long love mission where we first started to sell wholesale. We thought that was our path because that was the only path actually being shown to us. Once we realized the Internet could help us sell direct to consumer, a couple years ago, I switched that in 2018 to sell locally to community and have some other small wholesale accounts in the greater 60-mile area. But really, honestly, the way to make money and be profitable is stay close to the farm and stay on the farm.
Good. So your flowers, the stuff, do you make bouquets on your farm, or do you wholesale to other green flower florists?
Yeah, we will if they ask, but our primary mission now is to sell directly off the farm or delivery. So we have a variety of products, from a pre-sale, a very economical bouquet you can pick up every weekend for $20. You can find us at the market in Pella on Thursdays at Pella. And also anyone can order a bouquet or an arrangement, anything to do with celebration of life. I have a la carte wedding options, DIY buckets. People have events. They don't want me to arrange because I'm a little bit expensive. They can buy the flowers, and we can advise on how much to buy based on how much their vase count is, and they can go have that experience themselves. So our mission is to really get nature into the hands of other people, whether it's arranged by us or whether they do it themselves.
Good.
I saw on your website that you write about this do-it-yourself wedding thing where the wedding party comes out and what do they do? They pick and arrange and do their whole thing themselves, and how do you inspire them?
I struggle to design if I don't know the people. So a part of us getting to know them, if we're going to do full design for them, is them coming and interacting with the flowers about a week or two before their event. And brides will always tell me, well, I only want this color, and that's the way it is. But once I get them in the garden, it all changes. And they say, well, I really like this flower, and I really like this color. And then their whole world opens up to experiencing something they never knew about until they step into our farm garden. And so really, when you're working with clients that have specificities before really knowing what the product is and what it is about, our job is to get those clients into the you know, field and let them experience it for themselves and make better decisions, you know, that can kind of just open up their whole view of what flower farming is.
So it's part of the wedding experience then.
Yeah, and anyone can do that as well. I mean, I have people call and say, I have this special event, it's this color, and I'll say, well, just come on out if you're really particular. Otherwise, we try to choose the best for them because we know what's best in that season, and we'll give them a variety to work with.
Growing flowers, growing flowers commercially, for a lot of people is amazing because there are a lot of challenges, weather and bugs and all that sort of thing. You mentioned you wrote a little bit on your website about a lot of commercial flowers are shipped in. There's not a lot of most of the market is flowers shipped from a great distance.
Right, and it's kind of the dirty secret of American society when it comes to flowers. 80% and upwards of 85, sometimes 90%. You know, like during the winter months. Countries, and if you didn't know that this happened, but Ecuador had a huge strike where they stopped shipping out roses for 3 to 4 weeks, and it really impacted a lot of traditional florists who depend on those roses coming in from those countries. And commercial flower farming in other countries is not regulated by us. They can use whatever chemicals they want. They can pay their labor whatever they want, and they can use any type of transportation and use for whatever method they want to get those flowers to the United States. So by the time they get to us, I like to call them dirty flowers. You know, you don't know what they've been. You don't know who worked for nothing to get them here. And also the environmental impact of flying them is huge and a huge contributor to our CO2 emissions. And so what we like to say is you have a choice. You know, you have a choice to buy flowers locally. We are one of those choices. We're not going to discourage the other choice, especially But there are flower farms all over Iowa that are willing to sell these amazing flowers grown locally and often chemical-free. So it just takes a quick search on Google to usually find them, and we're one of those options in Southeast Iowa.
I'm glad that sort of option is really taking off. I've run across other, organic flowers, is that it? Or at least chemical-free flowers. And when you think about it, these flowers are going to be placed on tables with food. People are going to hold them in their hands. People are going to put their noses into them and breathe. So it's really nice to not only have healthy flowers around you, but support local growers too. Donna, you wanted to talk about their farm store.
Yeah, you have a great website. You want to tell us? Let's see. I noticed you sell peppers and what else?
Yeah, I had to figure out a way to economize our how we work with our customers. And so one of those was a pickup farm store station that's air conditioned. And so people can order from us and save a delivery fee and just drive on the farm and pick up at their leisure. It's in an air-conditioned little, I call it the little blue barn, and it's magic. It's like you go in, it's in there, and then you leave. And we don't, the customer's prepaid. We don't necessarily have to have a conversation with them unless they want to. That allows us to keep farming instead of having to pay someone to work at a brick and mortar, which I honestly can't afford. And so that magic little blue barn, our pickup station, our farm stand, has been really powerful in bringing affordable flowers to the customer. We do have hot sauce. We have other canning goods that we've wanted to sell in the past, but now those laws have changed, so now we can have that opportunity. So it just started last year, and we're hoping for a bigger, better future for the Little Blue Barn and our pickup station, our tiny little farm stand.
Good.
Talk about how the food laws changed this year.
Right. So I had to research this morning to make sure I was not giving false information to everyone. But on June 14, now the cottage laws have changed to not just include baked goods. Now it's for shelf-stable goods that don't need to be either heated or in a cooling environment. So to me, that brings back canning, and that means selling those canning items direct to consumer. This doesn't mean a necessarily wholesale or retail item. The state of Iowa is saying it has to be sold direct to consumer. So for all these years, we've been wanting to sell our tomato sauce that is a family recipe, and also my grandma's sweet relish, which is amazing, but I haven't been able to do it due to the restrictions of our laws here in Iowa. And so that just changed, and I believe this fall you'll be able to get a permit for that.
So where do you do all this canning?
Well, now I can do it at our Airbnb, the Barnes Swallow Cottage. I mean, I'll tell you, I've applied for like 10 grants to get a commercial kitchen, and I'm denied every time. So finally, I wrote a spicy letter to Governor Kim Reynolds and said, these laws need to change. Otherwise, food scarcity and our ways of sharing food, the history around that is going to be lost. Maybe someone listened. I don't know. But here it came, this huge change for people to make their own food in their own kitchens as long as they're regulated, and now they can sell them at a farmer's market. Now I can sell it in the Little Blue Barn.
That sounds great.
So you're growing tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers as well as flowers?
We have been. We've raised over 350 tomato plants in the past. Due to the drought this year, I didn't get one in.
Well, you don't have tomatoes.
Not this year, right? We used to. For over 10 years, we've grown between 100 and 500 plants of tomatoes and grew between 250 cucumber plants. We do have our peppers this year. That's part of an incubator farm program with Jason, and we help him farm where we give him a space to farm peppers, and he processes those peppers into pepper juice, which is a hot sauce, essentially combined with Himalayan salt and vinegar. And then we sell that through our farm store and at market. So it's this nice little collaboration we have with them, because I can't do everything.
I was wondering.
No.
It sounded like pretty busy days to me. I really am so glad that you, and it's a good wording here, that you sent a spicy letter to the governor. I hope they listened. I hope she listened. That was good. Yes, because getting food, local food to local people, is a very important thing.
Yeah, I mean, rural culture was built on sharing food. You would go to your neighbors, you'd pick apples and make applesauce, or you'd have a plethora of tomatoes and they would can them for you, and then you'd get the bounty of that harvest. That whole culture has completely changed, and I think a lot of it was due to these restrictive laws, where it said you couldn't can anything anymore and you couldn't share it with anyone because you were going to make someone sick. But I believe almost like 90 to 95% of the time, those who are canning want to can good food, and they don't want to make other people sick because they want to sell the product and they want to make money from it and share it with other people.
That's true. And the incidence, it's funny, but the incidence of food poisoning doesn't usually come so much that we hear from farmers markets, but we hear food poisoning from, oh, heaven knows, lettuce from California and things like that. There are things to look for, but we have to learn how to feed ourselves. And I've been part of farmers markets too for quite a few years. I'm retired now, but the idea of having all of this produce and watching it not be used, because that's also a skill that people are losing too. Canning things. Oh, you also mentioned you have a bed and breakfast. Another thing on your plate.
Yes, I also do not like to wake up early and cook food for people.
Like me.
I'm not technically a bed and breakfast, but we are an Airbnb. And what that means is people can rent a beautiful home across from our farmstead. It's self-check-in, It's called the Barn Swallow Cottage out here in Oskaloosa, Iowa, and it's 3 beds, 2 baths. I did a slight renovation on it when I bought it in 2019 into 2020. So I renovated this house through COVID and somehow kept everyone healthy. All the contractors were very kind and making sure, you know, everyone was working together on a safe level. And it's on 3 acres, and everyone can look at the farm. They can come and experience the farm when they come here. And that's a huge part of our financial portfolio. I honestly don't think I could be here in Iowa without it. I really need that income to support the house and the bills to the house, the upkeep to the house. Like, I need a new roof, siding. If there's any benefactor out there that'd like to help me, I welcome it. But that helps me. And then Barn Swallow then is able to cash flow our really great labor, whose fair wage paid better than most people who work at farms, to create loyalty and teamwork around the really delicate, tough work that we do here at Barn Swallow for growing flowers.
That's great. I'm speaking to a fellow Airbnb Airbnb barns, place for people to stay. Our farm also does a farm stay. We have people come and stay. And as I tell them, I don't like to get up and feed them breakfast. So it's not a B&B. It is a bed and get your own darn breakfast. But I've really been heartened by people that seem to get joy out of coming to visit a farm. Maybe they've never been before, or they wake up in the morning, and I've had the experience of people saying, oh, it's just like my grandmother's. It sounds like it used to be. And besides flowers for the eyes, it's a nice experience to give to people. How long have you been doing the Airbnb?
Well, I knew to pay the mortgage that I needed help. And so what I do is I stay at the farm during the summer months. And then this is essentially on the market with Airbnb, you know, through that time, because that's our busiest time. So the influx of people I normally see coming from March till October. And it's hard to get people down in rural southeast Iowa during a blizzard. So I don't have too much expectations over the winter months, but we will get a couple bookings here and there.
Good for you. And it's a nice way to visit Iowa. It really is. It isn't just all corn and beans. Best of luck to that venture, too. Although keeping it up, along with keeping up everything else, is a challenge. You obviously have more than just you working on these projects.
Right. I mean, our staff is very flexible. So if we have to come clean the cottage, the Barn Swallow Cottage, because someone is coming, then we have to do it. And so every week I have to look at the challenges we have between harvesting, weather, the types of flowers that are opening up, what has to be harvested. Like, already on Monday, I knew these types of flowers have to be harvested because we need to slow them down, we need to cool them off, and these other types of flowers can wait a little bit longer in the field while we get all these other things done. Maybe I have to go check on the chestnuts. Maybe I have a medical appointment. Maybe I have to do some laundry at the cottage. We just kind of are extremely flexible and multitasking in what we do. And whenever we hire anyone, we just say, you never know what you're going to have to do here. We don't just flower farm. We farm in Airbnb. We farm in all different types of ways. And if you can hang with us, then you'll stay with us.
Good. It sounds like a good definition of a farmer in general. You have to wear many hats. We're going to take a little break here and come back and talk much more about flowers and farming and all sorts of things. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a waltz. Somehow waltzing and flowers go together. That was waltz called the Waltz des Petites Jeunes Filles, the Waltz of the Little Girls, played by the Barn Owl Band. A fine thing to dance your way around a flower farm. We're talking to Meredith Nanakoven from Barn Swallow Farm. And Meredith, talk more about flowers. Talk about your methods. Do you have outdoor growing, greenhouse growing? Tell us a little bit about how things work.
Right. Part of our sustainability mission is to only grow outside, and that is a huge challenge because a lot of the commercial industry was built on only growing in hoops. There are challenges to growing in hoops. There are pest factors, watering factors, turning over soil, amending it, refeeding it. And I think that what we can do at Barn Swallow is show people that growing only outside is an option. Now, if you grow outside like we do and it's all open, there are only certain types of flowers that can handle the wind, the sleet, maybe minor hail, high winds. We have straight line winds that have come in the last couple years that have really been hard on our flower crop. And so there's ways that we farm that might be a little bit different from those traditional growers that are relying on hoops to have a full season of flowers. And we still have a pretty full season of flowers, starting in March with lilacs, moving into tulips, then moving into peonies. Then we move into our summer annuals and then pushing into fall with dahlias. And then we also have tree crops for greenery in the winter months. So I'd say we can still do it. It's still possible. And I think that's what's part of sharing our message, is that this type of farming is also profitable and can be done here in Iowa.
So you have to be very careful about selecting Iowa hardy varieties. What are some of your favorite varieties? What grows well outside during a derecho?
Well, I'm a couple of crops I'm really happy with over the last couple of years, which have just mistakenly landed on our soil, so to speak. I tried, we germinate 95% of our seed in our greenhouse. So a lot of the trialing comes and starts from that space. Once we put them into the ground, I would say we've had maybe 50% failure in what we want to keep for the following years. But varieties I'm really excited about. Obviously, Snapdragon, you can't go wrong. Early season in Iowa with Snapdragons. We grow rocket varieties. They seem to deal with the wind really great. Here in Iowa, too, asters seem to be a really great mid-late season option for beautiful color. And I took a chance on a Bonita variety this year that no one else is growing, but I researched it through the Japanese growers, and I thought, well, if it will grow well there in that type of climate, it has to do well here. And I have like 3-foot stems on some of those out in the open. Peonies are just a solid crop for us. We've always loved peonies. We've always grown peonies. I think we'll have over 1,500 plants. They love to be grown in Iowa. And then we have dahlias. Dahlias are a little bit more specific in their needs, and they're a little bit whiny, but if they're grown in a certain way, they can be profitable. They can do very well in Iowa. They love the heat. But this year we've not had great rainfall in southeast Iowa. It's been very debilitating. And so what I'm seeing in these crops is how far we can push them, what's the irrigation that they need, if they need it out in the field. And that will help us to continue to know to retain what we want to retain in the following years.
Very good. Yeah, tell me more about dahlias. I see them in seed catalogs, and they seem a bit much for me to want to tackle because they don't come from seed. And you end up describe the flower. What you get when you get a dahlia?
Well, there are some growers that have started dahlias from seed, but a majority of the way people are growing dahlias right now, they're buying tuber stock from other growers, and you can ensure the type of flower that they grew the previous year through the tuber stock. You can't necessarily ensure it through the breeding of the seed, just in case it's cross-pollinated with something else. So we do sell the tubers. We started selling them this year on the farm. We had a huge crop failure in the last 2 years of losing specific varieties. So we're growing back up to the point where we can, you know, share tubers with people. But the dahlia is really special. It's a plant grown on a straw, basically. It has a hollow center, and it fights all summer long to grow, you know, between 4 and 6 feet tall to produce these luscious blooms. But the thing is, we fell into the trap of growing blooms that aren't necessarily good for our environment.
Ah.
So we don't grow big old dinner plates or soft petaled lily pad. They call them lily varieties. We grow varieties that the bugs can't chew through the petals, like honeycomb round varieties, and also varieties that just put off a lot of blooms, and their tubers really are bountiful in the soil. They don't need a lot of rain. They don't, you know, they're not real finicky. So over the years, we've gotten rid of things that just can't handle it in our garden. If you can't handle it, they're out. You know, they get X-nayed. But the things that we've kept, you know, chimicum, the chimicum series, those types of dahlias really love to be here. And those are like large ball, like honeycomb like dahlias. Those types of dahlias love to grow here in Iowa.
Oh, that's good to know. What's the difference between a tuber and a bulb?
Well, I'm not a horticultural expert,
but what is it?
I would say a tuber has, you know, more of a possibility of recreation in the ground, kind of like a potato tuber. Potatoes and dahlias are they're in like almost like the same family. So if we had a famine, you could come to our farm and eat dahlia tubers. We were really hard up. But I've never tasted them, so don't go out there and start frying them up. You know what I'm saying? They're more valuable in flower form. But I think tubers have just a higher value in recreation, whereas bulbs, they tend to need more time, like a tulip bulb, for harvesting, and that's why we leave it to the Dutch to produce those types of things in their sandy soil.
Ah, very good. So the dahlia tubers, you put them in, do they stay in the ground all winter?
Oh, yeah. This is why they're a labor of love.
Aha, see?
Because like a canna, they have to be dug up every fall. So we have this giant dahlia dig every fall, these gorgeous, beautiful dahlia clumps. And all we hope is that they stay in that form until the next February. So what happens is we'll dig up the whole clump, we'll wash it off, or we'll make sure they're super dried out with no moisture on them. And then we'll put them in vermiculite in tubs with holes in them. And then over the winter months, we keep them in 45 to 50 degree insulated temperature, which is our garage. And I'll also put a fan on them with a humidifier that I have to fill up every 2 days. So they want moisture, but they don't want too much. They want to be dry, but they don't want to be too dry, right? They're very sensitive. And for the first time in over 12 years that we've been growing dahlias, I had like 90 to 95% success rate. And a lot of people were telling me to do it this way, and we defied them. We defied them by putting them in pine shavings. We put them in peat moss. We did all these other things. But for the way we grow them and the facility that we have to keep them over the winter, this worked perfect for us. When I took them out in February, the tubers were still rock solid, like I had just brought them out of the ground. And then we went into dahlia division, which is a bit of a surgery process. It does take some time. It took me 3 weeks this year with some help from my Aunt Sherilyn to divide them. And then once we got a lot of our first cold season crop in, then we took the dahlias out, labeled them all, put them in the ground. And that's a whole other process as well. We validate eyes on the tubers so that we're not growing things that may not have the potential to grow. We actually look for the eyes. It has to have at least one eye on the tuber to be a valuable plant.
Like potatoes. Potatoes.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, it needs an eye. Finding the eyes is a process. There's a whole, everyone that talks about it online, about finding eyes and making sure they're viable tubers. But we've transitioned to making sure that what we put in the ground will grow and that it will grow well.
You're doing all this in March.
So dahlias love hot weather. The soil really needs to be between 60 and 70 degrees solid when you put them in. So we put in like our snapdragons and our cold season annuals first, and then we'll transition to dahlias when that ground heats up. This year it was late. It was pretty chilly. until later May, early June. And once it got hot, we threw them in. So yeah, they like a warm veg to wake up. So to sleep, they like it to be cold and dry, but to produce, they like it to be warm, and they do like moisture. They do like a good watering every couple days.
And these,
where are dahlias indigenous?
I looked that up. I know it's some, not in America. They're not indigenous here. I do not know that answer.
Well, I'm glad they're becoming indigenous here in Iowa. That's and you use them. They're a good cut flower then too. They're part of the bouquets you make and Oh, good.
Oh yeah, they're a great cut flower. I mean, they take a lot of management. You know, first when they're about a foot up out of the ground, you know, we're already pinching them back. You need to pinch them back when they're small, and when these delicate little stems come out, because you don't want to pinch back when their stalk is like an inch wide, because that just welcomes all the bugs of the world to go in there and make a home. So pinching back is important, pinch, pinch, pinch in early spring, and then that branches out into having more blooms. So our strategy of growing outside is heavy pinching and cut and come again flowers, because I'm not a big supporter of bed turnover all throughout the season if I can help it. We do direct seed, we do have tubers, you know, we do switch out and pull out some early season annuals to plant warm season annuals like zinnias and cosmos. I planted directly into our tarp this year, which not a lot of people are doing. But I don't know what point I was trying to get to here, but I could go on and on, I guess is what I could say.
Well, what else are you planting for your bouquets for this time of year?
Right. I tend to be a maximalist designer, unfortunately. It doesn't work to my advantage sometimes in early spring when all you have is a tulip to work with, right? I tend to like to work with 10 to 15 varieties in a bouquet. So just this past week, I was putting in snapdragons, ageratum, celosia, marigolds, lysianthus, zinnias, cosmos. I had this morning, I think I harvested like 2,000 stems of lemon mint monarda. Some of my favorite things this year, you know, like our scabiosa crop has been great. Status is always like a staple on our farm. We put basil in our bouquets. I know Bluegate does that as well. I listened to that their session, Jill's session.
Mm-hmm.
And any other thing we can find perennial-wise, we have a huge crop of wormwood that never disappoints, and tansy. We have a large selection of viburnum as well that we can throw in there for any other type of greenery. So at any one time, you know, and there's amaranth. There's so much to talk about here. At any one time, I could put probably 15 to 25 specimens in a bouquet. And that, to me, is a barn swallow bouquet. Like, that's a bountiful, awesome product that not a lot of other people can make. And that's why we're unique here.
So you do keep some perennials to make your life a little easier.
Yeah, I'd say it's really hard to manage perennials. They need mulching, they need weeding. But we only, again, buy the perennials that are what we call double or triple threats. So I love fruit trees like a crab apple, because I can use that foliage in early spring when it's blooming. Then I can use the berry foliage when it hardens off in the fall. And it's also great for habitat. So if you're looking for a diverse woody product in your, you know, your flower farm or flower garden, it would be a crabapple tree. They're just great. That's a triple threat for me.
So you recently had a PFI field day at Barn Swallow Farm. And what kind of questions and reactions did you get during the field day, people who had never seen your farm before?
Well, I'll tell you, I was really nervous because it was like 80 people on our farm. I've never had that many people at once come to look at our flowers. I can't remember half the questions because I was so nervous to try to entertain everyone and make sure everyone's questions were answered on the day and everyone was seeing what they needed to see. people were really curious about the irrigation because we've not had a lot of rain here in Southeast Iowa. We did talk about cut and come again varieties, pinching, our style of growing in tarps. I would say some of the questions also pointed into like our vision and our mission and how we're regenerative and sustainable. People love how I talk. I always sell this, like, and it's true, you know, use what you have what you use, and how do we do that? And so I brought up two stories about my dog, Bella, who we happened to adopt her, and I just wanted a friend on the farm and just a companion. But now she's become a wildlife distancing manager as well.
A good, good term. Cornered,
yeah, she's already cornered a raccoon and a groundhog this year. That could be really devastating on your flower crop. And so she's not only my best friend, but she always works with us. And so she was already there, and we just, you know, she just naturally, we put her to work. We also have a giant cottonwood tree that's probably 75 to 100 years old. And when it's shady in the afternoon, that's where I put annuals that need a little break. So something like an aster, or some of our dahlias are in that shade. And also, using a tree for shade in the afternoon to give that a break, I think that's pretty ingenious. We're using that tree literally for our style of growing in that area that covers a pretty large area. It's a 15 by 150 foot space. I think that's what a lot of people came away with. And I also think a lot of people are scared to get into flower farming for the pretense that flower farmers aren't farmers. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. Like, we are farmers. We're probably better farmers than a lot of the people surrounding us because of all these species we have to deal with. They all have different personalities. We have to cut them at different times. We have to hydrate them at different times. They can be styled in different ways. They grow at different times of the year. Like, who else has to deal with that but a flower farmer?
And who gets pleasure from, I don't know, a bowl of cornflakes? I'd rather get a nice bouquet myself. I mean, flowers are a gift. They're a wonderful gift. I'll take a little break here, reminding us this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. And you can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen and this fine radio station at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. We are talking flowers. Meredith, I'm so glad you had such a great turnout. Good heavens, I hope all those 80 people that came to visit your farm didn't step all over things. That's one of the things that's pretty amazing. And you talk about farming as there are so many different parts, and you have to keep all those balls in the air and doing everything well. But some of us are just home flower gardeners. Here in Iowa, do you have any tips for just the plain old backyard or in the corner of their farm flower gardener? What would you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, you can grow a lot in a really tiny space. You can grow a lot in a 5 by 5 foot space. We sell in the early spring, we sell a package of seedlings so people can have their own fresh cut flower garden. The same stuff that we grow at Barnesfall, they can have a little piece of that at home. Some people I know, they're only container growing, so I have to factor that in as well. They're just farming on their patio. And so I'd like to say that, you know, probably when those PFI members came out, it looked so big, right? Like, how can I possibly do this? But you can take 4 or 5 of something and make a lot of flowers out of it. If you use cut and come again varieties, you can cut a lot of flowers out of one plant. You could have a really nice bouquet every couple days if you want. I would say you need great soil. You need to soil test and know what your soil is like and what's there. Is there clay right underneath? Do you need to add compost? The soil testing is uber important, number one. If you're putting into containers, you know, that soil should be as fresh as it can be, but I've seen people reuse soil. We've reused soil. This year I did a huge test, and those flowers are doing really great. But I added amendments, I added compost, and I added some other things. We're even trialing dahlias in containers. They do really great. So test your soil. Know your soil, I think, is number one. I do compaction planting, which is kind of inspired by my mom. She would always plant things super tight together to reduce weeds. But what do we have in Iowa? Weeds. And a lot of the weeds come on because of these huge temperature influxes that come in throughout different times of the year, like May. May was like 95, 100 this year. And here come the weeds, right? Here come those early spring weeds. So tight together, would say. And grow things that you, if it's a cut garden, grow things that you can cut and come again.
Flowers are
so wonderful.
Can you explain
the cut and come again and what kind of flowers are cut and come again?
Yes. And that was actually a question brought up, like how many of these flowers can we cut and come again? Almost literally everything grown on our farm is cut and come again. From a snapdragon, those are cut and come again. Amaranth, celosia is cut and come again. Ageratum, pretty much everything in our garden now is styled that way. You know, I'm just imaging some of the things in my mind. Marigolds are a prime example. We grow the Coco series, which is just brilliant in form. We have things like basil. If you whack down your basil, it's out in the garden right now, it will come back. It will flush back. So cut and come again style, that, you know, intertwines with pinching. So you need to be out there pinching early to make sure you can maintain this cut and come again style throughout the summer. But cutting above the leaf nodes will be important. So if there's no leaf nodes there for it to come back, like on Veronica, then it's probably done. It's probably done for the year. And it's going to need some water as well.
Cut judiciously. And I would like to put in a plug for a very brash and bold summer plant. Zinnias always bring a smile to farmers markets and all over. But zinnias, of all my flowers, somehow the Japanese beetles like the zinnias. Do you have Japanese beetles visiting your flowers?
Yes, we do. We have them this year, and there's a huge discussion about Japanese beetles and what to do. So I would just say research and do what works for you. For us, we did have to put out some bags this year to draw them away. The bags are about 50 to 100 feet away from the garden to pull them out. We did have damage in our zinnias, but they're eating the leaves. They're not necessarily preying on the buds. And I like to have a late season zinnia because so many farmers have them in early season. And so we've pinched back, we've let them feed on the leaves, and they're eventually going to be gone. But they have created some damage. But at the end of the day, a lot of our annual foliage, what they like to eat, we're not using those leaves. We're stripping those leaves off in the field anyway. So let them eat, let them have their buffet, do what you can. But at the end of the day, you have to realize that, like my dad always said, all God's creatures must eat. You have to create places for those bugs to eat and forage. And one of those ways that you can do that is called beetle banks. This is not a new phenomenon. Like, it's something that's been done a lot in vegetable growing. It needs to be done in flower growing as well. You need to plant perennial bushy plants like yarrow, hyssop. I have globe thistle in there, four by row right next to our bed so that good bugs can harbor in there, like praying mantis and ladybugs, and go in at night and eat all those bugs that like to eat our stuff, like aphids. Aphids are a bigger problem for us than Japanese beetles.
Yes. Oh, goodness. Beetle banks, good idea. I do wish they'd stay away from my raspberry patch, but that's actually, we had worse problems with Japanese beetles last year. And yes, I have used those Japanese beetle traps to lure them away, and you'd be surprised how full those bags can get. Chickens love to eat the bags that I emptied out. So very good, very good. Well,
I will say the water irrigation has helped. They don't like to be rained on. No bug likes to be rained on, and we have overhead irrigation.
Ah.
So that could be helpful to people if we have another dry year next year.
Ah, good idea. Good idea. Do you have any final thoughts you want to leave people with? And also, how can we find out more about your farm? What's your contact information?
Right. You can check out our online e-commerce site, which is also serves as our website at barnswallowflowers.com. We also have Instagram and Facebook pages as barnswallowflowers. Look for us. And we post every day. We're very transparent about what we do, and we do that for the luxury of the customer to know and be have a connection to us. We have a style of programming. We were one of the first flower farms, actually, in Iowa to have a CSA program and launched that, which can be signed up for in November. And then people right now can buy anything from us, from arrangements, wrap bouquets, our weekend bouquet. There's a variety of ways to get involved with us. We will have U-Pick later this fall, which will be new to the farm, and we are late with that because of the drought. So everything's coming on later, and we're having to make sure we can secure what we need for orders and market in July before we go there.
Good. Sounds like a lovely farm. Not only a place to grow food and flowers, but it's a place to stay. And, oh, it sounds wonderful. It sounds absolutely. Thank you for all the information about flowers, and especially dahlias. They've always been kind of beyond me, but I just may give them a try. You never can tell. Good. Thank you for being with us today, Meredith.
Yeah, you girls are fun. I love being on here talking with you all, and what a great experience.
Good, thank you.
Well, maybe we'll get some rain tonight. That would be good for everybody. We'll see.
Keep rain dancing.
Oh, we do, we do. Very good. Well, thanks to Meredith for being with us today. We talked about flowers and using some creativity on the farm to grow a lot of things. Donna, give the folks some information about our new podcast project.
Yes, you have multiple ways now of listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can do the radio version, or wherever you get your favorite podcast, just go and put in Donna Lana, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen, and up we should pop.
We're good. We're good. We're starting to put them up now, so you can find us any old time. And for more information about Practical Farmers of Iowa and their field days, which are fun things, go to practicalfarmers.org. Lots of good information there. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. You heard a waltz and couple of reels to end the show here, Road to Boston and Trip to the River. Always nice to have some good music. Support this fine radio station. And be sure to stop and smell the flowers. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Pukintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.